Welcome to the Duart Historical Society meeting today. We're privileged to have folk from the museum in Napier here. Lizzie Ratislav will be the principal speaker. She is curator of the design collection. And later in the meeting, we may be joined by Trofina Cracknell, who's the Kaitiaki Taua Māori for the museum. So we hope she will join us later. The topic this morning is inside the wardrobe of the Honourable Whetū Terekatini Sullivan, who we'll all remember. Mrs. Terekatini Sullivan has been the MP for some years for this particular area, and of course her father was famous in that regard too in earlier times. I once sat beside Whetū Terekatini Sullivan on the aeroplane coming back from Wellington, so I know all about her. Lizzie, thank you for coming today, and we look forward to hearing what you have to tell us.
Thank you. Now, from the moment she swept into Parliament in 1967, Whetū Terekatini Sullivan captured New Zealand's hearts and minds, not least for her bold sense of style. Whether in her office or on the marae, the young Māori politician turned heads emblazoned with contemporary whaifai patterns. Of fashion and politics united two of Whetū's passions, marking the beginning of a journey that would see her become New Zealand's longest serving female Member of Parliament and our very own fashion icon. Now, as many of you will be aware, the Hawke's Bay Museums Trust was recently gifted an important collection of garments from the wardrobe of the late Honourable Whetū Terekatini Sullivan. And this nationally significant collection was gifted to us by the Terekatini Sullivan family and will be celebrated in the MTG Hawke's Bay's upcoming exhibition, Whetū Terekatini Sullivan Travel in Style, which opens on the 27th of September. Given Whetū's national profile, many ask the question as to why Hawke's Bay. You mentioned earlier that she was MP for this region, so that's one of the reasons, of course. But I thought I'd just begin by unfolding some of those other connections and how we became entrusted with the care and display of this wonderful collection of garments. And the museum's relationship with Whetū and her family goes back more than a decade now. It was in 2001 that my colleague Lucy Hammonds and Douglas Lloyd Jenkins took a research paper on Whetū's clothing to the Courthold Institute in London. It was a paper that explored how Māori motifs had appeared in New Zealand fashion over time, and Whetū's own story sort of took quite a central place in that in history. Whetū later had been highly supportive of Douglas and Lucy when they were doing their research for their book, The Dress Circle, and again Whetū's story found quite an obvious home in that anthology of New Zealand fashion. And it was really through this relationship that Whetū had come to believe that the Hawke's Bay Museum Trust's collection would be a fitting home for her surviving gowns. Of course, Whetū died in 2011, and after that her family were keen to fulfil that wish. And then in 2013, which is where I come into the picture really, the donation to the museum was formalised and plans for an exhibition of those garments got underway. I went on a trip down to Wellington to meet Whetū's husband, Dennis Sullivan, and her daughter, Mayana, who live in Mayo. That was the first time I met them, saw the garments, and from there we bought a selection of those back for the museum collection. But the connection to Hawke's Bay does not stop there. Whetū's love of fashion reached back to her Hawke's Bay whānau. In her early years, she was raised by her maternal grandmother, Amelia Henrici Solomon, a talented dress designer and tailor from the settlement of Mohaka in northern Hawke's Bay. Taught by her grandmother, Whetū learned to design, knit and sew her own clothes. By her early teens, she was already incorporating Māori motifs into garments, and she continued to make most of her own clothes right up until her entry to Parliament and beyond. It was on the 11th of March 1967 that Whetū won the Southern Māori by-election and became the youngest woman ever elected to New Zealand Parliament. Following in the footsteps of her late father, Sir Eruwera Terekatini, she was to serve the vast Southern Māori electorate. At the time, Southern Māori was the largest electorate in New Zealand and the Commonwealth, and it stretched from Stewart Island all the way up the east coast of the North Island as far as Gisborne, so that included Hawke's Bay. And in this image, we see a young, confident female Māori politician standing on Waimarama Beach in her southern Māori electorate. Her dress too, I'll explain, is another link to Hawke's Bay. Soon after that by-election, Whetū was visiting constituents at Rauponga Memorial Hall in northern Hawke's Bay, where she was struck by the unique curtains that featured in the hall. The bold and contemporary textile design was the work of Hawke's Bay artist Sandy Adzi. 1967 was also the year of the controversial Māori Affairs Amendment Act, and Whetū hit the ground running with strong opposition to a number of the clauses in the Act. In recognition of her advocacy for Māori, Sandy Adzi sent her a parcel containing 3 yards of printed white linen fabric. The design featured a prominent mangopari, or hammerhead shark, pattern, a motif that Adzi saw as a reflection of Whetū's strength and fighting stance. Whetū said it was a spectacular piece, bold and definite in its black stylized Māori motif, and the most exciting thing that happened to me that year. That was a pretty important moment. Adzi had suggested in a note to her that it might have been suitable for curtains or cushions, but Whetū, being the young and fashionable woman she was, transformed the fabric into the striking shift dress which you see her wearing in this photo. For Whetū, the discovery of that fabric in Rauponga sparked her renewed interest in applying Māori motif to clothing and would be the beginning of an ongoing collaboration with Sandy Adzi. The dress she made was a visionary act, demonstrating her understanding of the power of fashion to convey a contemporary Māori position. Now, in a sea of grey suits, Whetū turned heads with her long, elegant gowns, decorated with those contemporary kōwhaiwhai motifs. This is one of my favourite images I've come across from the Alexander Turnbull Library collection, and I feel it very much illustrates just how much she stood out in the crowd. Whetū is wearing another of the garments in the collection, a soft gold silk dress, decorated again in a Sandy Adzi kōwhaiwhai. She has a delicate black neck placed jauntily over her hairdo, open sandals and matching handbag, a complete and perfectly calculated outfit. This, of course, is an image dating from 1972, when Norman Kirk's Labour Party won the election. This is the Kirk cabinet, which for the first time included 2 Māori, including Whetū, who became New Zealand's first ever female Māori cabinet minister. Whetū's choice of clothing was always well considered. She understood the power of fashion, as I said, correctly judging that clothing could provide a common ground upon which important messages could be delivered. While the garments themselves are simple in design and construction, the patterns range from bold and assertive through to subtle and nuanced. And that sort of created a visual language that she drew upon with a lot of insight, really, judging different events, choosing different outfits. You see here, this is an image where she's down full front in the crowd meeting the arrival of the 1975 Land March on Parliament grounds. This is a rather bold design by Māori designer Kura Ensor. It's a one-shouldered dress, and even more striking in colour because that kōwhaiwhai pattern is in black, red and white. She chose more delicate and abstract arrangements for other situations. Here she is at the International Women's Year Conference in Mexico, also in 1975. She wears one of her floating silk gowns, delicately hand-blocked with Māori motifs by one of her favourite designers, Christchurch-based Fanny Buss. Here she projects an image of confidence and femininity. Now, her floating silk gown was one of Whetū's iconic designs. Made of a lightweight silk, the whole garment could be rolled up in a handbag and pulled out for her glamorous appearance at an important event. Her wardrobe very much suited her busy lifestyle, and as MP for Southern Māori, as well as Minister of Tourism, Whetū travelled extensively throughout New Zealand and internationally. This was a huge commitment, requiring between 80 and 120 hours of work and at least 800 kilometres of travel each week. Despite the considerable effort, Whetū always emerged at the end of a journey impeccably turned out in her signature style. It's her again in another version of the floating silk gown to her husband. Whetū's wardrobe was also one of a working mother. Bold patterns cleverly disguised spills and sticky fingers. Whetū found her skills in design and dressmaking particularly useful throughout her 3 pregnancies. her signature loose-fitting caftans, offering perfect maternity wear, concealing any obvious changes in the weight. So this was taken in 1973, and Fitu at the time was pregnant with her son, Tilly, who was born in 74. But it was in 1970 that Fitu became the first pregnant MP to ever walk in the halls of Parliament. And she always felt that her clothing helped to gently introduce that idea to the majority of men that surrounded her. When carrying her first child, Mayana, Fitu worked tirelessly, missing just 6 days of Parliament when the baby arrived. She was always determined to balance her career and family. And Fitu created space for her new baby in her parliamentary office and continued to work alongside her. So there, baby Mayana and Carrie Cott in Fitu's office. As her family grew, Fitu very much continued that important emphasis on her family, her children and husband often appearing at her side, travelling with her, and unsurprisingly, they were very often all, or some of them, kitted out in their own striking Māori motif fashions. So that's Mayana there wearing her poncho made by Kōwhai Knitwear, who also made this vest, which is in the collection. Mayana's poncho has a smaller version of that same kaneko pattern. Dennis too. Fitu had a lot of garments made for Dennis, often by Kōwhai Knitwear as well, Wellington Mays Company. And yeah, lots of wonderful photos of the whole thing kitted out. As Fitu's persona grew in the public eye, so too did her interest in fashion and her desire to promote the use of Māori motifs on fabric. While she enjoyed creating fashion designs herself, often taking a sketch pad to pass time while waiting at airports or on flights, Fitu was aware that there was a community of artists and designers whose talents and philosophies could have a wider reach. Putting herself into the role as a patron and advocate for Māori design, Fitu realised she could provide important support both to those making Māori fashion and those wishing to wear it. And with a bit of encouragement from her husband, Dennis, Fitu developed her personal interest in fashion and her own skills into an idea for a small boutique, which she called Ethnic Art Studio. That's the label from one of the garments in the collection, which carried that label in her shop. There were two different labels that she produced. This one is the international range, which she was trying to target at a more international market. In the years leading up to the opening of Ethnic Art Studio on the 18th of December 1972, Fitu spent whatever spare time she had, usually 1 hour in every 12, gathering ideas and researching handcrafts from around the world. "I love researching," she said to a New Zealand Women's Weekly reporter, "to see the variety of hand-woven fabrics from the sheerest pure silk to exclusive New Zealand hand-woven tweed and the burst of colour in the various ethnic prints." Fitu had much enthusiasm for this new project, stating she felt revitalised by her creative endeavours. As she travelled, she took the opportunity to meet with various fabric printers, spinners and knitters who supplied Ethnic Art Studio. I mentioned before one of her favourite designers, Fanny Buss, who is based down in Christchurch. Fanny is no longer with us, but her daughter, Dee Truston, is a wonderful source of information, and she very much remembers Fitu as being quite an exciting customer and her visits to their studio in Christchurch. You know, Fitu may have selected garments when she was on her trips around the country, but mostly, you know, her selected handcrafters were sending out products to her shop. And Ethnic Art Studio was situated in Perrott's Corner, which, if you know, Wellington is on the corner of Willis and Manners Street. It was at the time just opened as quite a trendy new shopping complex. And she said that her boutique set out to provide host and hostess leisure wear using ethnic handprints, including traditional Māori design. They were all unique and made of the highest quality fabrics and found a particular market with the executive wife in need of something when travelling abroad that would readily identify her with New Zealand. So that, I suppose, is that market that she was trying to target with this international label. It was about putting New Zealand and New Zealand design on a world stage. Fitu's role in Ethnic Art Studio was mostly one of patronage and as the coordinator of talent for others. However, she did continue to contribute some of her own designs for sale through the boutique. Her designs usually combine glamour and practicality, simple shapes made bold through innovative patterns and fabrics. This is one of her signature bags that she designed. You can just see on either side, they come in a whole range of colours. They're made of a very simple canvas, lightweight, affordable, easy to produce. Fetu's whole idea with them is that they're a perfect A4 size, so they fit all of her documents quite nicely inside. And the idea with the handle was that it would just sit over her forearm, leaving her hand sort of free for delivering speeches or greeting constituents or whatever it may be. So that she has in all sorts of different colours, different fabrics, one to go with every outfit. And for the pattern on the bags, which appears on both sides, she worked with Sandy Edsett again to come up with that pattern. The heavy work commitments and family life forced Fetu to relinquish Ethnic Art Studio to the care of her shop manager. It had quite a short lifespan, closed around 1975. But Fetu did continue to design and have garments made for herself and her family. Design and dressmaking was very much a lifelong passion, with those early skills she inherited from her grandmother, combined with her own innate sense of style. Fetu was to leave a unique mark on the history of New Zealand fashion. Through her own designs and patronage of some of the most radical artists and designers of the time, Fetu made it clear she understood the power of fashion. Labour lost the election in 1975, and so Fetu, while she never really returned to the limelight of the cabinet bench, she did keep dressing in this way, using her fashion very much as a means of projecting her personality, her culture, and her political goals. This is the graphic for the exhibition coming up. Now, the exhibition very much focuses on that same period that I was talking about, so from 1967 when she was first elected through to 1975 when Labour lost that election. That's the period we see as, you know, very much being the peak of her public profile, and it was the period where her own creative endeavours and her designing was at its peak as well, and so the garments in the collection date from that period. I've only shown you, of course, a very small selection of the garments because I didn't want to give it all away, but there are 26 garments that came in the collection, and we have also borrowed a number of other items, several dresses plus some jewellery, the bags, which are being held onto by the family for now. This Fetu's daughter, Mayana, often enjoys wearing her mother's designs, and she's holding onto those.
Are there any questions? What did she wear in winter?
Her wardrobe was trans-seasonal, but you often see her layering sort of black polo knees underneath the gowns. I think you saw that in the Land March photo. She's wearing that, you know, one-shouldered gown that she had a sort of black skivvy underneath. A lot of the gowns as well, they've got a long split up the side, so they're actually worn with trousers, so more like a tunic. Yeah, I mean, that was part of her. She had a very practical approach to fashion that sort of very much comes through, and one of those things was, yeah, she liked that ability to be able to layer the fashions. And they were all very loose-fitting garments, so she was easily able to do that.
So she's had three children. The oldest one is Mayana, and the other two?
Well, she lost one of her children, so she has two children, Mayana, who's been very much involved with the museum and the exhibition development, and Tiddy, who is a pilot based in Hong Kong. Yeah, he's all over the place.
Her husband, is he still alive?
Yes, Dennis has also been very involved with the museum and in this whole process.
So they'll be at the opening, I'm sure?
Yes, they will. Dennis is a physicist. He works at Tory University. He's a lecturer in astrophysics.
I was going to ask, you said that Sandy Edsett gave her the passport stuff. To make her example, did they actually use Marimoki in their interior decor in their house?
Yes, and I haven't really seen too many images of the interior of their house from that period, but it was present in some ways, not always in textile form, but I suppose Fetu had so many contacts with contemporary Māori artists that there was a lot of certainly contemporary Māori art in her home. Fetu's sort of interest in ethnic prints and pattern and Māori design did come into her work as Minister of Tourism as well, and Fetu did a lot of work researching and trying to promote the use of Māori handcrafts in hotels as Minister of Tourism. She did a lot of work pushing for that. I know she went on a research trip in 73 to Fiji. There's all these wonderful photos of her at the market looking at textiles and, you know, sourcing ideas to bring back to do sort of Pacific themed hotel decors.
I think I've got a visit
Yeah, here's a quite a popular, I think it came out as a magazine supplement, an entire book devoted to Māori knitting patterns. And some of the knitwear that I showed by Janice Hopper, called by Knitwear, drew from the patterns that appeared in those books that, you know, everyone had access to.
And that label that you showed for the National Ethnic Art, what was the word at the top?
Individuality. From ethnic art.
Individuality by.
By. Yeah. So I suppose that was, you know, highlighting the fact that these were all unique, one-off guns.
So the actual designs and shapes of the guns, do they have meaning?
You mean actual patterns applied to the textiles? Well, they do. I mean, I spoke about that hammerhead shark, the Mangalpari pattern, and that reoccurs in a lot of the pattern that Sandy Adzev provided. So they often do connect to Māori stories.
So it's no other questions. I'd like to say thank you to you. But I'd just like to add a little bit about Auntie Fetu. She was Auntie Fetu in our family. We knew her well. She was the most dynamic, exciting woman. She would sleep 2 or 3 hours a night, not much more. And if you went to see her, as I did several times, she'd often be having to have a sleep because she had to get ready for talk with me. She was exciting. When you asked about what was in the house, I remember the cushions had called fly pattern and the carpet.
Ah, carpet.
So it was a carpet, but I didn't go in it in the 70s because I wasn't here. And not long before she died, but as you mentioned, the Foreign Purposes Act, she came with our family when we were petitioning Parliament, got out of a sick bed to help us present our petition to Parliament. Not long afterwards. Okay. So she was very much part of our family. And it's lovely to hear more of her. And you've got the all off Cathy. Now, I've just seen Trofina walk in the back. And Trofina, I'll start you off by introducing Trofina. And I've worked closely with her in the last few years. There was a question regarding the patterns within Auntie Fetu's dresses, the court finalised. A question about the meaning of them.
Oh, I'm Kia ora koutou. Sorry to pop in at the last minute, but nice to be here. Yes, they do. A lot of them are like Māori traditional patterns, but they're slightly different, so they could be referencing different things. These ones here, the triangle shape is often a patiki or a flounder, and the little triangles are often used for a pattern called Niho Nepo Taniwha, which is a tukutuku pattern. So connecting to those traditional patterns. And so it was really new for her to take those patterns from the marae, from the traditional whanganui, and to be wearing them in her clothes. It was the first time that it had ever been done that they'd come out from the marae.
Just with this one, Fetu had a taniko headband, and she took that to Janice Hopper of Kōwhai Knitwear and said, can you turn this into, you know, something contemporary? And that's that pattern.
Was there any suggestion that it was slightly sacrilege to do?
I think because of who she was and the manner that she had, she was able to do it. I don't know if anyone's been publicly about that. Yeah. I think people were quite taken aback that she would so boldly wear the patterns. But, you know, there are some young contemporary designers working in this way now. So there's one called Adrienne Whitewood who's in Rotorua, and she has a tanikal print that's on the front of a silk dress. So it's still happening a little bit.
But you would... They change the pattern a little bit, so it's their pattern. You never use anyone else's pattern. You don't take anyone else's design. You give it an alteration and make it yours.
And that's something you probably looked at Sandy Adzev's pattern. Have you had a look at some of the dresses?
Yeah.
So that Mangalpari pattern is really quite commonly seen around the island in rafters, but he's just made it quite different from any of those. He's made it his own. And that particular pattern in Hawke's Bay also relates to the story of Pania and Moriwori, which is the hammerhead shark. Pania, the reef, and her son Moriwori, who takes the form of a shark or a stingray or sometimes an octopus. And so for Sandy, that probably had quite a strong connection to Hawke's Bay as well, isn't it?
That initial design that came from Raupami started it off, and what did that?
Well, that So similar to that, but he's just changed it a little bit so that it is his, just as Rose is saying. And have you mentioned about his new pattern?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, good. He's actually worked with us to develop another pattern that's also based on this, but again, slightly different, which we're going to have printed into a silk scarf. So we're very excited about having those available in the shop.
Yeah, copyright on the patterns?
On his patterns?
Or on any patterns, really.
But interestingly, he has given the copyright for that Māngo Pāre pattern he's done for us to the family, to Mayana and Dennis and Tim. It's a funny thing for Māori that copyright, in some ways, it's considered a great honour if someone, say if you've composed a waiata and then everyone starts singing it, then it's a really big honour.
Trifina, could I ask you, how appropriate is it for a Pākehā to wear a lady wearing a silk scarf with a Māori motif? Is that a compliment?
Interestingly, some of Fetta's patterns were actually designed by Pākehā artists, so she was quite open to working with contemporary Pākehā designers and artists as well. So Teo Schoon was one of those, and recently we found out that Don Salt did one of her Ponamu necklaces. So personally, I think it's appropriate. I always say to people who ask me about wearing Ponamu, for example, wearing a Māori design, that it's about who they are and how they identify themselves. So certainly I would think that a Pākehā woman, for example, could wear one of Sandy's scarves. He's gifted that pattern to everyone to be able to wear. But also I think for people in Hawke's Bay, it might be something that would be very special to wear because it says that you're from Hawke's Bay and it's from Hawke's Bay.
You have souvenir shops in Rotorua, say, selling items?
That's right. Well, you know, much as we can criticise that souvenir thing, for the Rotorua people, and actually nationally, the formation of those shops and all of that kind of culture went with it, actually saved a lot of their waiata and their traditional carving patterns. So at the time when a lot of Māori were moving away from that or being pushed away from traditional Māori things, that actually preserved it. So all of that kapahaka performance meant that all of the people were speaking Māori and learning songs and just keeping the culture going.
Because they hadn't come from it.
Right, yeah. It's huge. There's been an exhibition recently that's come out of Te Puia, which is Matatoki, looking at some of those carvers that came through that carving school, contemporary ones.
Trifina, you may like to stick around for a few minutes because people might like to have a chat with you afterwards, if that's all right. Okay.